want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your almost humble host is grateful to listeners who support this program, including David Pennell, Andrew Rush, Mary Gruber, Carl Hesterberg, too. If you're able and you'd like to help out, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. You can start a voluntary subscription via PayPal for just $5 a month. The links are on the right side of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, Joe Carson, one of the most successful federal employee whistleblowers in recent years. He's a nuclear engineer at the Department of Energy. He's going to ask you to sign on to his White House petition asking President Obama to be the first in 33 years to enforce the rights of federal employees who blow the whistle. And before the end of this podcast, Will Durst checks in. The title of his commentary is GOP Debate Fatigue. GOP Debate Fatigue. What could he possibly be tired of? 999? But first, are Republicans more dangerous than Democrats when they rule this nation? That's my phrasing of the book title from Professor James Gilligan. The actual title is Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. Professor Gilligan is at New York University, where he has two jobs. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry in the School of Medicine, and he is a professor in the School of Arts and Science. He spent many years on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and also ended up serving as the director of mental health services for the Massachusetts Prisons and Prison Mental Health. And his previous books include Violence, Reflections on Our Deadliest Epidemic, and Preventing Violence, Prospects for Tomorrow. Professor Gilligan, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Now, you have been dealing with the issues that lead to violence. You deal with death and suicide. Those are the two key areas of measurable statistics on violence. And you have studied all the way back more than 100 years and seen a very clear pattern. Please describe for our listeners what you found.
What I discovered was that the government's own data, this is from the National Center for Health Statistics, part of the U.S. Public Health Service, the data shows that since 1900, the death rates from both homicide and suicide have increased dramatically when Republicans have been in the White House and decreased equally dramatically when Democrats have been in the White House.
Now, that's a pretty stunning finding, and we're going to talk a lot about the variables here and some of the factors and caveats. But in a very broad sense, this is a critical indictment of what occurs under Republican rule in this country.
Well, I think that is one way that people would see it. I'm approaching violence as a problem in public health and preventive medicine. Mm-hmm. I am a physician, and I've been trying to understand the causes and prevention of this form of premature and preventable death, of these forms. One thing I was surprised to discover was that homicide and suicide tend to increase and decrease together. That is, the rates parallel each other, so that it suggested the possibility that at least it was possible that whatever was causing an increase or decrease in homicide might be having the same effect on suicide.
Mm-hmm. And here is a quick summary. Your book includes a lot of detailed data, and I invite people to read the book and absorb that for themselves. In an audio broadcast, it's hard to present numbers, and we can't show you graphs and other aids to help you digest the data. But here is a very clear summary. When we add together the sum of all the year-to-year increases and decreases in what you call homicide and suicide that occurred under each party, we find that the Republican presidencies showed a net cumulative increase in suicide rates of 14.5 suicides per 100,000, and that extends from 1900 through 2000. And the Democrats showed an almost equal net decrease of 13.3 suicides per 100,000. So the net swing here is the sum of those two, right? About 28%? Is that a fair use of the...
Yeah, about 28 suicides per 100,000 people per year is the difference between the two parties. In other words, the Republicans led to increases that were that different from the Democrats. And, or you could say the same thing the other way. The Democrats achieved a decrease of that amount compared with the Republican record.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you one more bite here of recent statistics. And here we combine suicide and homicide under the collective title of violent death rate. So when Bill Clinton took office in 93, he inherited a violent death rate of 21.7 per 100,000 from George H.W. Bush. And then it began a steep and consistent decline year after year, dropping below epidemic levels, which is at about 19, to 18.3 by 1997. And then his last year in office, it dropped to 16. And you say that it was not until a Democrat, President Clinton, became elected for two terms that the third and longest lethal violence epidemic of the 20th century, one that lasted for 28 years, finally came to an end. That's really significant.
You know, what to me was even more amazing is that's not the only time that occurred. There were three times during the last century when homicide rates and suicide rates jointly reached epidemic levels. Those occurred only when Republicans were in the White House, and the epidemics were ended only after Democrats got elected. Mm-hmm. Clinton was simply the third in the series. The first epidemic occurred after the Republican administrations of McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt, and Taft.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodrow Wilson brought the epidemics those Republican administrations had caused down to low levels. Then Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover in the Roaring Twenties brought the rates back to epidemic levels again, and Roosevelt, when he was elected in 1932, brought the rates down to the lowest of the century.
Professor Gilligan, I told you before we started the recording here that your book, I think, is very powerful, but it also feeds my bias. And I want you to listen to a little ditty here. I hope you're not a big Monkees fan. But this was put together by some satirists when George W. Bush was president, and it's called We're the Republicans. Take a listen, please.
Here we go, starting another war. We got our heads up our asses. You know, we're really bored. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans. And people say we act like clowns. We love natural disasters. Did somebody really drown? We lie whenever we want to. Yeah, you know it's true. And if you don't believe us, turn on the nightly news. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans. And people say we act like clowns. We just steal elections, run the country into the ground. We're just trying to be greedy. Our names are Bush, Cheney, and...
We just steal elections and run the country into the ground. So that's my bias, Professor, and I don't invite you to just engage here in wholesale Republican bashing. But as you can tell, your book provides fodder for a guy like me to say, look at over 100 years. The legacy of Republican rule is that more people suffer and die while they're running the country. And disabuse me of that. Is that an unfair conclusion to draw from the carefully reasoned arguments in your book?
Well, I mean, sadly, I think that is the conclusion you could reach. Again, let me just emphasize, this is the governance data. It's not my own data. I've simply noticed what it shows. And what it shows is that the Republican administrations could be seen as a risk factor for violent death in the same way that cigarettes are a risk factor for lung cancer, and that the Democrats are a protective factor against violent death in the same way that regular exercise is a protective factor against heart attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as a public health problem. And what we'd have to say is that the Republican administrations have been a danger to the public health. And that's what the data shows.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people say that sounds partisan, and all I can answer is, well, if so, all that means is the data is partisan. On the other hand, the data collection certainly was not partisan.
Mm-hmm.
These data were collected under the presidencies of both parties for the last century by non-political civil servants, epidemiologists and statisticians who have been recording each single year since 1900 all the deaths that occurred in America and what the causes were of each, and then what kind of rate that means given the size of the population. I should add, these are age-adjusted data, meaning we control for the size of each age group in the population. So these increases and decreases are not a function of, for example, the baby boom, when,
mm-hmm.
you know, during some years there'd be a surge in the population most vulnerable to homicide and so forth. That's not a factor here. This is controlled for.
Now, Professor, in your book, you go into some detail to examine the underlying causes. And from my point of view, the economy, foreclosures, and job loss are factors that lead to increases in violence. And it's pretty logical that if you're distressed and you've been kicked out of your home by a bank, that it leads to depression, despondency, and that can lead to suicide. And likewise, if you're desperate, you might turn to crime when you otherwise would have maintained a much more wholesome lifestyle. So to what extent are you able to parallel these increases in violent deaths that occur largely under Republican presidents with the economic policies that are really part and parcel of Republican rule?
Well, what I was amazed to discover was that I was wrong when I had assumed that the Republicans achieved what they claimed to have achieved, which is economic growth and prosperity. But I discovered that, in fact, the data shows exactly the opposite. During Republican administrations, without a single exception, throughout the last century, there has been an increase in both the rate of unemployment and the duration of unemployment, and a decrease in both of those measures when Democrats have been leading the country. I also found that recessions were more frequent, they lasted longer, and they were deeper under Republicans and under Democrats throughout the 20th century. Finally, that the level of inequality, that is the gap between the rich and the poor, in both income and in wealth, increased under Republican administrations and decreased under Democratic ones. So I'd say those three groups of economic variables really differentiate the two parties, and I think at least provide a partial explanation for the correlation between the political parties and the violent death rates.
Now, Professor, is your book pretty popular with the Occupy Wall Street crowd? Because you presciently wrote in this book, which was clearly completed and sent to press before these protests developed, you write repeatedly about the division between the 1% super wealthy in this country and the rest of us, the 99%.
You know, it's amazing. I don't know if that's a coincidence or they had picked that up from my book, but actually I should say many economists, and I'm not an economist, I'm really just quoting economists, have emphasized the huge discrepancy between the 99% and the 1%. In other words, the 1% meaning the wealthiest 1% in the country. That the wealthiest 1%, for example, earn more income per year than the least prosperous 90%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's unbelievable. We have the highest degree of inequality of both of income and of wealth in America today than we've had since the era just before the Great Depression. In fact, many people feel the inequality that existed then was one thing that precipitated the Depression of the 1930s, just as many people, many economists, feel that the inequality that began really starting with the time the Republicans got back into power in 1968 after 32 years of Democratic hegemony. When they, from 1968 and pretty much up to now, the inequality in this country has been increasing, particularly under Republican rule. It increased, it continued to increase under Clinton, but only at about a third of the rate that it had been under increasing under his Republican predecessors. And it started back up again with a vengeance under George W. Bush. Where it will go with Obama, I just don't know yet. I mean, it's still too early to say. But we do know that the recession we are now experiencing, or that we, you know, by some measures, we just got out of, occurred right on schedule under George W. Bush. I mean, it's typical that when Republicans are in the White House, recessions start, and they're deeper. This is the deepest since the Great Depression of the 30s. And they last longer.
We're talking with James Gilligan, professor of psychiatry at New York University, the author of this new book, Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. And let me read a couple of power quotes here, if I may. So the mystery is this: how can the wealthiest 1% of the population persuade the other 99% to agree to a system that is so clearly biased against their economic interests? The Republican Party's solution to the problem of how to persuade a majority of the voters to support the party that increases their relative poverty has been to pit the members of the lower middle class against the very poorest lower class, thus distracting the attention of both classes from the fact that it is the upper class and the party that represents its interests that is picking their pockets, not each other. As long as the near poor are fighting with the very poor, neither will fight against the rich, or to be more exact, against the whole social and economic system that divides the population into a tiny number of very rich people and a huge number of poor and near poor. And, Professor, we've seen this play out this year very clearly, starting in Madison, Wisconsin, this concerted, orchestrated assault on the middle class. And I agree with your analysis here. They are trying to force a merger of the middle class with the lower working class in this country. And the problem I see here is not only the greed and the immorality of this, but that this flies in the face of the self-interest of the ultra-rich, because we're the consumers who buy the crap that make them wealthy, whether it is, you know, financial instruments or imports from China. All of these benefit the uber-wealthy in this country, and yet they seem oblivious to the long-term impact of eviscerating the consumer class that feeds them.
That is absolutely true, and it's one of the extreme ironies in all this data. I think what it demonstrates is the irrationality of greed. That is the irrationality that people can manifest when they're motivated by greed. Ultimately, as some people have pointed out, unregulated capitalism is its own worst enemy. You know, even Henry Ford, back in the 1920s, recognized that if he didn't pay his workers enough money in wages, they wouldn't have enough money to be able to buy the automobiles he was manufacturing.
Well, and Professor, I don't know if you recall, but at the Super Bowl last year, this past year, Chrysler unveiled their M&M commercial promoting the Chrysler 200. And it was based on the whole grid of the city of Detroit and how it's been through hell and it's come back and that they know how to make cars. The problem is that the $14 an hour new hires on the Chrysler assembly line can't afford to buy a Chrysler 200.
It's like when people get too greedy, they forget the lessons that even some of the most successful corporations and manufacturers recognize, like what I just quoted from Henry Ford. You realize a lot of other CEOs are not as smart as he was, and they do things that, in the long run, ultimately even hurt them. The depression of the 30s actually hurt the wealthy. On the other hand, don't think they didn't do everything they could to maximize their profit-taking right until the disaster happened.
Mm-hmm. Professor, a couple of pages later from where I just quoted, you go even further. You say there's also another conflict of interest here, a political one. It is in the political interest of the very rich for the country to have high rates of violent crime, since the higher the crime rate, the more the voting population is able to be divided and conquered, as the high crime rate alienates the middle class from the poor and the poor from each other, the nonviolent majority from the violent minority, by whom they feel most directly and immediately endangered. When that happens, the middle classes are less likely to vote for the party that identifies itself with the interests of the poor, who are seen as violent and dangerous, and the poor are less likely to vote for the party that is less punitive toward the criminals. This is a fascinating look, and it kind of dovetails with Tom Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? But you provide more of an inner description. Tom Frank's approach is that people are being duped into voting against their self-interest with phony promises of a ban on abortion or other cultural issues. But here, you put it in a much more stark dog-eat-dog context.
Yes, and let me emphasize, I don't mean this as a conspiracy theory, but I think it does describe what actually happens. What I mean is, I'm not saying that there is a a committee of the ruling class that meets every Monday morning to inquire how can we raise the rate of lethal violence this week. Obviously, it's not that crude. But what I am saying is that it's to the advantage of the Republican Party to have high rates of crime, as have been recognized by political leaders, and therefore they have no incentive, or certainly much less of an incentive, to look seriously at what is actually causing the increases in rates of crime and violence. For example, Barry Goldwater's campaign manager said that crime in America is a free multimillion-dollar gift to the Republican Party. And George H.W. Bush's campaign manager, Lee Atwater, said that crime is the issue with which we will divide the Democratic Party.
And that's why
divide and conquer.
That's why he stole the Willie Horton card from Al Gore and made it a big deal in defeating Michael Dukakis.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Republican Party, what's most ironic here is the Republican Party has run on the campaign to be tough on crime, whereas, in fact, it's precisely under Republicans that violent crime increases the most. I mean, that's why, it reminds me of George Orwell's, analysis of misuse of language by politicians in his great novel, 1984,
mm-hmm.
where, war is peace and slavery is freedom and so forth, a reversal of, the use of language to mean actually the opposite. I look at the war on crime and the emphasis on law and order that most Republican campaigners have campaigned on as an Orwellian, reversal of the plain meaning of the words in the English language.
Well, and we have to acknowledge that Republicans, as you just cited, have been extremely successful with crime as a wedge issue, and they've pushed Democrats back onto their heels because liberalism is now pretty much dead, and liberal Democrats were beaten with high crime rates and blamed for being soft on crime and bleeding heart, hug-a-thug types, all of that, which is not rational and does not actually relate to the policies of criminal justice and incarceration. But these are hot-button issues that are easy to play on what they call low-information voters, the people who don't pay much attention. And you pop in with a 30-second commercial during Wheel of Fortune, scare the hell out of people, and they're most likely just to do what you tell them.
That is unfortunately true. And what I'm trying to do is get the information in this book out to as many people as possible. Because, again, I can't repeat too often, this isn't my data. This is data that's been hiding in plain sight for the last century. And nobody's noticed it until now. What it shows, it shows that rates of lethal violence increase under Republican administrations, as do at least three identified groups of economic stressors or sources of stress that also increase during Republican administrations. And the opposite happens when Democrats are in power. So this is an extremely important public health issue. But it also, I think, provides a new way of thinking about politics. You know, when we talk about politics, we think, well, what's the purpose of American government? We know what it is. It was articulated in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The purpose of our government is life, not a suicide and homicide, liberty, not mass imprisonment, as we've had since Nixon declared his war on crime, and it's the pursuit of happiness, not the those ultimate indices of unhappiness with one's own life and the lives of others that suicide and homicide are symptoms of.
Well, and I would just add to that, Professor, that the oath of office that every elected official takes is to protect and defend the Constitution, not the American people. But it's been twisted, especially since 9/11, to try to rationalize all kinds of unconstitutional and aggressive tactics that represent an extension of executive authority, starting with the president, but his agencies as well. And it amazes me how people have just passively accepted this. And when you try to make an argument based on constitutional issues, they most often turn to emotional arguments that don't really relate to the premise.
Yes, and one example of this that I found in Massachusetts is we found that the most effective means in the prisons in Massachusetts in preventing recidivism or reoffending after prisoners left the prison was for them to get a college degree while in prison. We had several hundred who'd gotten a college degree in prison. Not one of them was returned to prison for after over a 25-year period. Now, I emphasized this in a public lecture I was invited to give, and our new governor was a Republican who gave a press conference and said, we've got to eliminate free college education for prisoners, otherwise people who are too poor to go to college will start committing crimes so they can get sent to prison to get a free college education.
Now, I'm trying to think. Republican governor of Massachusetts, that wouldn't be a guy named Romney, would it?
No. It was before Romney.
Oh, okay.
But the ultimate irony here is that after he did that, the entire United States Congress, the Newt Gingrich Congress that was voted into power in 1994,
mm-hmm.
Eliminated the Pell grants that which provided free college education and textbooks for prisoners. They eliminated them all over the country, not just in Massachusetts. And all of this, of course, was done on the rationalization that they were being tough on crime, when in fact what they actually did was to dismantle the single most effective program we've yet discovered for preventing reoffending after prisoners leave the prison.
Well, and that just shows that people are really not prepared to be rational about many of these issues. And Republicans, and to some extent Democrats, I mean, Bill Clinton, when he was running for president, rushed back to Arkansas to preside over the execution of a mentally retarded individual. And he knew that that was going to win him votes.
Right. Professor,
one of the real pleasant surprises for me in your book is your emphasis on shame and guilt as factors that lead to these violent events, homicide and suicide. Take a moment, if you would, to describe shame ethics and guilt ethics. They are different, but sometimes they interact in very toxic and lethal ways.
Yes. Maybe to start at the beginning, had discovered through years of working with violent individuals in our prisons that virtually without exception, when I inquired enough, got enough information to learn why they had committed the violent crimes that resulted to their being sent to prison, and I'm talking about murders and rapes and so on, the most serious crimes, what I would discover over and over again was that they had experienced, well, when I'd ask them why they had assaulted somebody, they would say, it's because he disrespected me, or he disrespected my mother, or my girlfriend, or my wife, or whatever. And that theme of disrespect, they mentioned so often, they abbreviated it into the slang term, he dissed me, says something about how central the concept is in their vocabulary. But what I discovered was also that these violent individuals had a moral value system, except that it was the opposite of yours and mine. It was a value system which the worst evil is to be disrespected or shamed or humiliated, and the highest good is pride, the opposite of shame. I began to realize there was a moral value system, which I came to call a shame ethic, which is the opposite of the Judeo-Christian ethic, which I call a guilt ethic, where the worst evil is to commit a sin or to do something that's evil. And the highest good is to be morally, you know, innocent of evil. And you can only be innocent by protecting others and taking care of them and not harming them. So I discovered there were two opposite value systems. But what is most striking to me is that when I looked at the social psychological research that's been done on Republican legislators and voters, both, what I discovered is that they are much more in the realm of a shame ethic, where the highest good is to be capable of eliciting admiration from others and the pride of being richer than others. They tend to divide the population into the superior and the inferior, and to get pride from saying, well, we're part of the superior. You might say the superior 1% as opposed to the inferior 99%. And that you can understand the psychology of Republican versus Democratic politics by understanding that they're based on opposite moral value systems. The shame ethic tends to legitimize and reinforce homicide or violence against others, although it can also lead to suicide when a person feels that he has been disarmed and there's no way he can escape endless shame. Mm-hmm. Because he's no longer able to harm others. So shame can lead to suicide as well. Guilt is an emotion that inhibits people from and prohibits them from doing harm to others. The sad thing about guilt is that when it becomes overwhelming, it can stimulate suicide, but it is certainly a powerful force against homicide.
Mm-hmm.
But both of these emotions, I should say that guilt tends to be stimulated only to suicide levels only when the person has experienced a humiliation that stimulates rage, and then that under the pressure of their guilt feelings, they direct the rage against themselves. They take it out on themselves. They feel guilty. They feel they deserve punishment, so they'll punish themselves and so forth. At the extreme, that can lead to suicide. But what is clear is that if you don't have an event that stimulates levels of shame and rage, the people motivated primarily by guilt feelings are not likely to commit either homicide or suicide. So I'm suggesting that Republican politics is shame-dominated, whereas Democratic politics is more sensitive to issues of guilt and of one's moral responsibility toward others and how guilty one would be if one either neglected or harmed others.
Well, and hearing these descriptions, Professor, it reminds me of my friend, retired state senator from California, John Vasconcellos. He led a commission on self-esteem here in California. And from Doonesbury on down, he was the subject of all kinds of ridicule. But the underlying issue is really substantive. And I believe that self-esteem is at the core of healthy beings, and that there are many things that chip away at self-esteem, and some people never actually get much of a reservoir of it. But I think it's a very important element of human interaction and thus public policy. But it was the Republicans who came down hard on him and said, oh, you want people to feel good about themselves. How frickin' crazy is that?
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. It's impossible to overestimate the importance of self-esteem in human motivation and psychological health, and with respect to issues of violence or nonviolence. But let me also add something that Malcolm X said once, which I thought was psychologically very profound. He said, nobody can give somebody else self-esteem. People can only gain that for themselves through their own achievements and accomplishments, and becoming the kind of person they can admire. But what we can do toward others is we can deprive them of the resources they need in order to gain self-respect, resources such as the opportunities for education and for work. So if you deprive people of a chance to get a good education, or you deprive them of jobs by increasing the unemployment rate, you make it impossible for people to gain the self-respect that people normally gain through acquiring knowledge and skills that other people will respect and that they can respect in themselves, and for being able to do the kind of work that they can respect and that will elicit respect from others.
Finally, Professor, I wanted to ask you just to thumbnail for our listeners the research that you sketch here that shows a substantive difference between so-called red states and blue states when it comes to capital punishment, imprisonment, and violent deaths.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me preface this by saying that I discovered that the rates of suicide and homicide are significantly higher in the red states, that is, those that voted majority for the Republican candidate, George Bush. And the rates are significantly lower in the blue states, which voted for the Democratic candidates. What makes that less surprising than it might at first appear is that the red states, the Republican states, support on a communal level, I mean at a level of law and government, a whole range of practices that constitute the placing of a positive value on violence and a negative value on nonviolence. For example, if you ask how many people are executed by the criminal justice system in the red states and the blue states, do you know what the difference in the ratio is? The red states execute 22 times more people than the blue states. I mean, that's going back to 1976 when capital punishment was reinstituted in response to the Supreme Court's outlawing it.
22 times.
22 times. Wow. Since 1976, there have been more than 1,100 executions in the red states and only about 50 in the blue states. Of the 14 states with the highest execution rates, all 14 are red states. The majority of the red states the red states make up a majority of the states that have capital punishment. I mean, I could go on and on, but the point is, it's an extraordinary difference. I mean, it's not minor, and it's capital punishment is a way for the government to say that it is morally and legally acceptable to kill other people as a way of expressing your disapproval of them, If the government does it, then I think it decreases the sense that people might have that it's not an acceptable thing to do.
Professor, I see your book is published by Polity Books. There's a website there, POLITY, politybooks.com. Do you have any other websites related to the book or your work that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I am putting together, I don't have it yet, but I'm putting together a website in which I want to post a couple of dozen charts and graphs and tables, plus some supplementary, kind of minor chapters that would explain further some of the material in the book or deal with some of the questions people might have about it. That will be called, just without any spaces, jamesgilligan.com.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I don't have it up yet. I hope to get it up within the next week or so.
Okay.
And it will, for those who are, like me, are kind of fans of charts and graphs and tables and numbers and so forth, it will provide a lot of the raw data on which the summaries are based that are in the book.
All right, well, tell your web person to get cracking, and I'm sure by the time this is released, some of our listeners will be able to click on it and get some visuals to go along with your description here today.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I hope people will find it useful.
All right, the new book, Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. We've been talking with James Gilligan, professor of psychiatry, New York University. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
In segment two of today's Peter B. Collins podcast, engineer Joe Carson returns to our program. Joe has a claim. He is one of the most successful government employees who has blown the whistle on wrongdoing and been able to hold on to his job. He works as an engineer for the Department of Energy in Tennessee. Joe, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, it's great to be here with you and your listeners, Peter.
And you've got an important petition drive with the White House that's underway that we want our listeners to know about and, if they're so inclined, support. But before we get to the petition, we need to lay down a little groundwork here for people who may not have heard your previous appearance on the program. You, in particular, focus on the rights of individuals who protest PPPs. Those are prohibited personnel practices, and it often takes the form of reprisals or some kind of retaliation for people who have blown the whistle, who work for the government and are protected in general by civil service. So tell our listeners a little bit about the legal history of PPPs and the so-called merit system principles.
Sure. Okay. I've been at this now for 20 years, Peter, and I'm hoping to hopefully be in the bell lap of figuring out why I'm a licensed professional engineer in my background very quickly. I had a scholarships to high school and college. I ended up with a Navy ROTC scholarship in college. I was handpicked by Admiral Rickover to serve in the nuclear Navy. I served as an engineering division officer for 6 years on nuclear submarines. I've been a licensed professional engineer for over 25 years. I built three commercial nuclear power plants in the 80s, and I've been a safety engineer at the Department of Energy since 1990, and I've been a whistleblower since late 1991.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the 20 years, I'm very analytical and very tenacious. And ultimately, I'm a federal employee, but ultimately my reasons for blowing the whistle were in large part because as a licensed professional engineer, I have a positive duty to blow whistles independent of employer when public health and safety is impacted related to my professional duties.
And I want to say that between my own podcast and the co-host job that I do with Sabelle Edmonds in the Boiling Frogs podcast, I've talked to more than two dozen whistleblowers. And, Joe, you're the only one who still has his job, his pension, and, in many cases, individuals lost their security clearances simply because they did their duty either to protect the public or to protect the integrity of the system that they worked under.
Yes, and that's what I'm trying to get to is, Peter, and I think you kind of alluded to it, and I'm going to elaborate a bit. So the Federal Civil Service, in 2 minutes, prior to 1883, way back in 1883, the Pendleton Act was passed, And that was a result of the assassination of President Garfield in 1881 by a disappointed office seeker, because prior to the Pendleton Act in the 1800s, all federal employment was basically patronage. It was, you know, to the victors belongs the spoils. And if you were a federal employee and the parties changed, you would likely lose your job and be replaced by somebody with the party, you know, from the party that had prevailed at the White House. So as a result of the Garfield assassination, you know, he lingered on for like 7 or 8 weeks. It was a pretty gruesome death. And other reasons, Congress created the Federal Civil Service. The biggest single change between 1883 and 2011 to the Federal Civil Service was the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978,
okay,
which was a post-Watergate reform,
mm-hmm,
because Nixon really politicized the agencies, as I believe you're aware, Peter, you know, with your background. And so what was the fundamental purpose of the Civil Service Reform Act? And when I'm kind of a Reaganite to say trust but verify, and ask any of your listeners if they wish to look up the finding and purposes of that law, which is codified in the U.S. Code. And I'm paraphrasing, but I think it's a fair paraphrase. But the fundamental purpose of the Civil Service Reform Act was to create the statutory framework and the implementing agencies so that federal employees, as myself, and the people that you've interviewed, including in the intelligence agencies,
mm-hmm,
they are part of the Federal Civil Service, would be adequately protected from what are termed, and the codified in law in the Federal Civil Service Reform Act, prohibited personal practices, the acronym being PPPs. They would be adequately protected from PPPs, which includes reprisal, but it also includes discrimination, includes cronyism, nepotism, personal favoritism. You know, the point is that federal employment is to be based on merit. You're hired on merit, you're promoted on merit, you'll be disciplined or fired for lack of merit, as opposed to your political party, your race, your gender, your personal relationship with your boss. You know, it's supposed to be based upon merit principles. You've used that term also.
Gotcha.
And the merit principles were also codified for the first time by the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978. So one of the merit principles is that federal employees can voice concerns and not experience reprisal. Therefore, if an agency engages in reprisal against, you know, an employee, then that is a prohibited personal practice. So there's something of a hand-in-glove relationship between a merit principle and a prohibited personal practice, in that an agency violation of a merit principle is a prohibited personal practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's that, you know, the relationship. So whistleblower reprisal is one type of prohibited personal practice, and it gets a lot of press, and I'm not saying it unfairly,
mm-hmm,
but a federal workplace that allows any kind of prohibited personal practice is more likely to allow every kind of prohibited personal practice, including reprisal, as well as other kinds of dysfunction and corruption. So my point is, we should be, and what the law says is that federal employees will be adequately protected from prohibited personal practices without distinction. Okay, so I think we should be putting more of a focus on that, because that's what the law has, and I'm being your engineer, follow the rules, and that would include whistleblower reprisal. Whereas you focus too much on whistleblower reprisal, there's a mismatch, because the law does not, by and large, single out whistleblower reprisal as a type of, you know, from other types of prohibited personal practices and how it's to be staunched, if you will, or prevented in the federal workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and so when you, as a civil service employee, are subjected to PPPs, a prohibited personnel practice, what are your rights and what is the ordinary process of recourse?
Well, I'll be an engineer for another minute.
All right.
The system created by the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978, and it was somewhat modified by the Federal Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, but not in great part, in somewhat, but not in great part. It's a three-legged stool, okay? And the system to ensure federal employees are adequately protected from prohibited personal practices, it's a three-legged stool, with the legs being the agency head, you know, of the employee's agency, the U.S. Office of Special Counsel being the second leg, and the U.S. Office, the U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board, the acronym being MSPB,
mm-hmm,
is the third leg, and the acronym for the Office of Special Counsel is OSC.
Right.
So So I'm trying to keep the control the acronyms, but I'm in a Fed for 20 years. It's hard.
We understand. Merit Systems Protection Board. I often have trouble remembering the words that MSPB stands for.
And there's a little nuance to that because it's Merit Systems, plural, S, not just Merit System. And I may get into that nuance because it's somewhat relevant to the Federal Reserve, and as a matter of fact.
Well, go ahead and explain that.
Well, okay. We have, there are multiple merit systems within the Federal Civil Service. Within the executive branch. The Federal Civil Service will be one merit system, but there are other parts of the executive branch that have somewhat different merit systems, i.e. Government corporations, the Federal Reserve, the Office of Management and Budget in the White House. You know, they're all part of the executive branch. Employment is governed by merit principles, but they're a little bit different than the merit principles that were codified in the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978.
Okay.
Okay, and that's relevant to the intelligence agency whistleblowers, because I can make a statement, and I'm being the engineer, but the statement that you have all these caveats, and I want your listeners to see the big points, and then if they want to go a little further, we can drill down a little bit further into the nuts and the bolts. But I mentioned this three-legged stool. So the agency head is charged to prevent prohibited personal practices. That's in the law, shall prevent. The Office of Special Counsel is charged to protect employees from prohibited personal practices. And the Merit Systems Protection Board has two different roles. And in this context, I'm only going to mention one. The Merit Systems Protection Board, its primary role is as an adjudicatory body, somewhat similar to the Department of Labor for hearing appeals about discrimination in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about that function here, though. It has an additional function termed its special studies, in quotes, special studies function. And what the law directs the Merit Systems Protection Board and special studies function to do is to conduct special studies determine and report to the President and Congress as to whether the public interest in a civil service free of prohibited personal practices is adequately protected.
And when was the last time they completed and published one of these studies?
In 33 years, the Merit Systems Protection Board has never reported to the President and Congress as to whether the public interest in a civil service free of prohibited personal practices is adequately protected.
But they're working on it, right? I mean, after 33 years, this must be a blockbuster report.
Yeah.
And any day now, they're going to release it, right?
Well, it's the analogy I use is the inverse of the Garden of Eden, because if you look at the legislative history, the MSPB was kind of given a broader charter to study a number of things related to the civil service. But this is what was the one thing that was codified in law was the one thing it was directed to study, and it could, I guess, given the latitude to study other things. So the analogy I make is the inverse of Garden of Eden, where God makes the Adam and Eve, puts in the Garden of Eden, says, eat everything of all the trees and fruit except this one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And with Congress and MSPB said, it creates the MSPB and says, do special studies of everything, but ensure you study this. And they haven't studied the one thing they were told to study.
Yeah. And now, as we look at this, the Merit Systems Protection Board, which was set up at least in part to battle cronyism, it has repeatedly been packed with cronies of the sitting president because all members serve at the pleasure of the current president. Do I have that right?
No. The Merit Systems Protection Board, it has about 300 employees, so it's a tiny agency, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, and it has a three-person board. Those three people, nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate for a 7-year term. So they do not serve at the pleasure of the president.
Okay.
However, the three members cannot all be of the same party.
Mm-hmm.
So if a president changes, sometimes you'll see a board member leaving early, but they can be removed for cause, but they do not serve at the pleasure of the president.
Okay.
And the same is true of the special counsel, of the Office of Special Counsel. The current one is Carolyn Lerner, and actually just today as we're speaking, there's a story about her in the Washington Post, which is very positive. She's been in place for 4 months, and she's done things in 4 months in the Office of Special Counsel, which it hadn't done in the previous 32 years.
Uh-huh.
So there is some reason for hope at the Office of Special Counsel.
Interesting. Now, let me.
But she serves, again, president nominated, Senate confirmed for a 5-year term. So she does not also. She is also not at the pleasure of the president.
The Office of Legal Counsel has a 5-year term?
No, the Office of Special Counsel.
Special Counsel.
The Special Counsel of the Office of Special Counsel has a 5-year term.
Okay. All right. So in the 33 years that this Merit Systems Protection Board has existed, and you referred earlier to its adjudicatory function, where essentially appeals of prohibited personnel practices are brought before this board, has it ever ruled in favor of the employee/whistleblower?
Yes, occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the norm by any means, but it has occasionally. But I want to... I put more, you know, I mentioned it's a three-legged stool, so you can't, it's hard to just look at one in isolation. You can look at one in isolation, but then you have to see it with connection to the other two. So let me, another analogy. I'm a regulator, okay? I'm a nuclear engineer, and I regulate, in a sense, in the Department of Energy. Department of Energy is, some of you, your listeners may know, it's unique in the federal agencies in its dependence upon contractors. Because it had the nuclear weapons mission, and decisions were made that the Department of Energy would own the facilities that would producing the weapons, but they would be operated by contractors and contractor employees.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will say that, you know, the Department of Energy has a workforce of 125,000 people, which is true, but only about 10% of those are fed and 90% are contractors.
Right. I'm familiar with the University of California operating the Lawrence Livermore Lab, right, and also the Los Alamos Laboratory as contractors to the Department of Energy.
Correct. So if you went to Los Alamos, I'll say 10 years ago, you might have had DOE, might have had 10 people on site, 10 feds, and you would have had 6,000 contractors. You know, so just to kind of give an example, which is similar to what I'm doing here, but then I'm regulating the sense of the safety of these contractor operations. But my point is I'm a regulator.
Mm-hmm.
And many federal employees are regulators of all the people or activities that are regulated by the federal government, whether it be food, you know, air transportation, you know, on and on, okay? To make that analogy, then, the Office of Special Counsel, OSC, is the regulator of the federal regulators, in that the Office of Special Counsel is to regulate, if you will, our working conditions so that we are adequately protected from prohibited personal practices, so we mm-hmm. can do our jobs without fear or favor, you know, per the Merit System principles.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Now, if you continue that analogy, then the Merit Systems Protection Board is the regulator of the Office of Special Counsel, in that the Office of Special Counsel, if it investigates a complaint of whistleblower reprisal and determines that the complaint has merit, it cannot order the agency to correct the action. It doesn't have that legal power. What it can do is as it puts on a prosecutorial hat, and it can pursue a case in front of the Merit System Protection Board, and if the Merit System Protection Board agrees that whistleblower reprisal has occurred, then the Merit System Protection Board can order the agency to correct that action. All right, so the Office of Special Counsel is more the investigatory and prosecutorial, and then the Merit System Protection Board, in its adjudicatory role, can then order corrective action. So my point is, as a regulator, if the Office of Special Counsel is being overzealous as a prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
well, it is in a sense regulated by the Merit System Protection Board, which will say you didn't make the case. We're not going to order corrective action.
All right. Know?
Okay, well, if OSC is overzealous, MSPB can regulate it. The other, what if the Office of Special Counsel is underperforming as an investigator? Well, that's where the Merit Systems Protection Board, with its special studies function, should be looking at the Office of Special Counsel and saying, you know, you're not properly investigating, or you're using the wrong standards, or you're not keeping the right records, or you know, so we're going to make a special study saying the Office of Special Counsel is not properly interpreting and complying with its lawful duties. You know, it's not complying with its duties to protect federal employees from prohibited personal practices. Therefore, federal employees are not adequately protected from prohibited personal practices, because the Office of Special Counsel is the specialized agency with that mission. It makes that report to the President and Congress. You would hope that they would correct it. Mm-hmm. You know, so my point is that the Marriage Protection Board has that through its adjudicatory role, it regulates OSC in one way, and its special studies role should be regulating the OSC in the other way. So hopefully you get OSC, you know, just right, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But that second part hasn't happened because in 33 years, the Marriage Protection Board has yet to conduct a special study of MSPB. Marriage Protection Board has yet to conduct a special study of the Office of Special Counsel.
Yeah.
So, if you will, kind of follow the chain down. So OSC is not, MSPB is not regulating OSC. OSC is not regulating the workplace culture in the federal agencies. And federal regulators, so who's got my back?
Yeah.
Which then has some explanatory power for a lot of the instances of lacked in stellar performance by agencies in regulating for the public health and safety, whether it be a BP Gulf blowout, whether it be 33 dead miners at the Upper Big Branch mine a year ago, or an SEC unable to catch a Madoff in 15 years, or throw a dart, any number of the things that you could say, this is why, you know, this agency is not doing well. My argument is, don't just look at that agency, because agencies are not that autonomous. You have to look at what, you know, is cross-cutting amongst agencies, which is the Office of Special Counsel and Merit System Protection Board.
Now, Joe Carson, as we look at a 33-year record of inaction, this crosses party lines and presidencies and control of Congress. And so there must be a strong consensus that no action by this the three legs that you just described, the agencies themselves, the Merit Systems Protection Board, and the Office of Special Counsel, there seems to be strong consensus among the insiders in government, even as it shifts from one party to the other, that it's a good thing for them to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, yes. I'm not going to disagree with that.
So where does that come from? Is it that they simply want government workers to disappear who raise substantive questions and issues of malpractice or improper activities, say, as you described, with a contractor? Do they basically want to see no evil, hear no evil, and if they do nothing about it?
At this point, you know, 33 years out, I kind of liken it to, you know, the Catholic bishops and pedophile priests, okay? Because if they were to admit it 33 years out, we've been wrong for 33 years, and this is some explanatory power for the existence and persistence of the security vulnerabilities exploited by the 9/11 terrorists, for the intelligence failures leading to the Iraq War, to the loss of space shuttles, to the failure of levees in New Orleans, to the inept response of FEMA. I don't want to say this is the only cause of these things, but it was could be a link in that chain, which, if not there, might have prevented those, you know, some of those things, or at least their consequences. I think basically everyone in the government, we don't want to look back. Let's try to make it better now. And no, mm-hmm. that's not the right answer.
You know,
if we've had government law breaking for 33 years. I think we need to say it, because what was wrong that allowed it, you know, and allowed it to persist for so long? And I had this conversation actually yesterday. I'm a nuclear for 35 years, okay? A lot of people know my name. I've been involved with professional societies for many years. I've been out there because I've been saying for many years, I'm fine with my engineering code of ethics. Where's my profession? It's not just me. My point is I was speaking to the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, which is co-chaired by Lee Hamilton, who co-chaired the 9/11 Commission.
Yeah.
And my argument to them was, if you don't listen to me now, because the 9/11 Commission did not, and I went to them repeatedly with these concerns, you know, I think America's, you know, the adequate safety for the high-level handling of the high-level waste created by America's nuclear facilities could very well be precluded, because if federal employees cannot, if engineers like me can't do their jobs in designing the structures and equipment and processes that's going to be handling this high-level waste, if we have to fear for our jobs to do our jobs, you're not going to get the necessary engineering. And if the federal regulators and EPA, DOE, NRC can't do their jobs without fearing for their jobs, you're not going to get the regulation. There's no way we can get an acceptable outcome for America's high-level waste.
Well, you're telling me about this Blue Ribbon panel for the first time, Joe, and all I can say is if Lee Hamilton's in charge, I wouldn't expect much to happen.
Yeah.
He's the most sincere whitewash expert in Washington, and they always grab him when they need a commission to report on a controversy and make it go away.
Well, we'll see, Peter. I hope, because if I'm correct, if the 9/11 Commission blew me off and blew off other whistleblowers, that means America is still today at an unnecessarily increased risk of a nuclear 9/11 or other catastrophe. Because if you don't diagnose the problem properly, you're not going to have the best prescription.
Well, and after the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf, and after Fukushima, I believe that people like you at the Department of Energy are critical to warn us when these contractors who are very loosely regulated and supervised run amok. And I think that these are very significant issues, even putting terrorism aside, just for the health and safety of our environment and the people who live near these sites.
Absolutely. Yeah, like it or not, and America has to trust people like me. And this is one of my critiques of this Blue Ribbon Commission. It talks about, we'll make this new federal corporation to be responsible. You can change the boxes, but you're still going to have people like me inside the box. Nuclear professionals. Sorry, there's only so many of us,
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had a conversation 2 days ago with a health physicist at DOE who's telling me, as of December, he's going to be working for his eighth contractor in DOE in the last 20 years. It's like you can get rid of the coach, make a new box, but he's still going to be the same players, people like Joe Carson. And if I can't play the game straight, I don't care how many boxes you make, I can't play the game straight, it's not going to come out right.
So, Joe, you are a prolific correspondent. Before we get to the petition that we want people to focus on, have you written Carolyn Lerner, the new head of the Office of Special Counsel, and has she bothered to respond to you?
Well, when she was in the nomination confirmation process, she told me that she would communicate with me once she was confirmed. She wanted to talk to me, but she basically said her hand was had said, for whatever reasons that the way that Senate confirmation works is, don't say anything. I mean, if you say something, they may have something to use against you. So I'm not blaming her. Okay, I'm not. I can see where she's coming from, given the way the confirmation process works. Since she's been confirmed, I've she's hired people whom I've known for several years. I've been in touch with some of them. So I'm presuming that they are then in turn in touch with her.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a case, as I mentioned, that's going to be forthcoming at the Supreme Court in a couple of weeks. And I'm hoping that this is another little nuance I've learned. Every so often, a couple of times a year, the government will tell the Supreme Court, we don't agree with this case, but we agree it merits Supreme Court attention. And I'm hoping that either Carolyn Lerner will persuade the Solicitor General to make that argument, or she could unilaterally moot my case. I don't want to know how much of the detail you want to get into the specifics of law, but what this case at the Supreme Court is about is you're a federal employee, and you allege whistleblower reprisal or some other prohibited personal practice or some other violation within the jurisdiction of the Office of Special Counsel. As of now, I mean, there's a split in the circuits about this, as a matter of fact. The Office of Special Counsel could say, we don't have jurisdiction, and no court in the land can review our negative jurisdictional determination. So essentially, you could just say, we don't have jurisdiction for anything. We don't have to explain it to you, complainant, and there's no possibility of a court review. So the issue with the Supreme Court is, district courts have jurisdiction to review when the Office of Special Counsel says we don't have jurisdiction to investigate a complaint?
That's a
pretty narrow legal issue, and there's a split in the circuit. So it's the normal paragon when the Supreme Court is trying to resolve a split in the circuits. But Carolyn Lerner could say, under me, we're going to the Office of Special Counsel policy will be governed by the Weber versus United States was the case in which the court determined they did have jurisdiction. District Court for the District of Columbia, she could say we're going to be controlled by Weber precedent, and if we close a complaint out based upon saying we don't have jurisdiction, we will not, and if that person takes it to court, we will agree that that court has jurisdiction to review our negative jurisdictional determination. Might develop some valuable case law about what the jurisdiction of the Office of Special Counsel is, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not that extreme. And then, further in my case, and this is actually, I'm getting into the inside baseball, but, you know, I listen to you, Peter, and I know a lot of people have lost security clearances, and I'm claiming that there's a possibility that the Office of Special Counsel could seek corrective action for anyone who's lost his security clearance in reprisal since 1989. And that because it has this ancillary jurisdiction where if there's any agency action prohibited by any civil service law, rule, or regulation. That was put in the law in 1989. And 22 years later, OSC has developed zero precedent about what that means. Mm. It has this, you know, it could potentially have all types of powers to restore wronged federal employees. And there's no statute of limitations either. So if in my case, one reason why I still have a security clearance, Peter, but when Hazel O'Leary, she was secretary 20 years ago, she had to put into the DOE regulations, it's a violation of DOE regulation to revoke a security clearance in reprisal.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not sure how many other agencies have something comparable to that, but if they do, then this ancillary jurisdiction of Office of Special Counsel, which is any agency action prohibited, so it has to be, you know, it has to be something that says you can't do this, and they do it, so there it is, you know, and by any civil service law, rule, or regulation. And what I'm arguing in this case, well, what is a civil service rule? And there's Supreme Court precedent saying agency personnel directives are civil service rules, which that means, even if it's not formalized in a code of federal regulations, but the agency procedure for security clearance has got to be some kind of directives, okay? And if those directives say you can't remove a clearance for improper reasons, well, I think, you know, in theory, you know, it had to be developed in the courts that the Office of Special Counsel, even, you know, 2011, go back to someone in 1990 saying, you know, they violated an agency regulation in removing your clearance for retaliatory reasons, and we can seek corrective action on your behalf to make whole. I mean, this Office of Special Counsel, Congress created in 1978 to have extraordinary restorative corrective powers for people that were wronged by PPPs, which have never, in 33 years, been, you know, what the limits of those powers are, because that depends upon the Office of Special Counsel and its discretionary role as a prosecutor trying to push the envelope, which it just has never done.
So, Joe, the Supreme Court case, is it Carson versus U.S. or DOE?
No, versus Office of Special Counsel.
Okay, Carson versus OSC.
Right, it's not docketed yet. The petition is due by November 3rd. But to go back to the bigger piece, the Office of Special Counsel is charged by law since 1989 to act in the interest of federal employees who seek its assistance, okay? So, no, it doesn't have an attorney-client relationship with someone like me, a complainant, but it's charged to act in our interest. It's not an ombudsman. It's not a neutral. You know, it's not an adjudicatory agency. It's an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So what it did in the case that's, you know, going to be going to the Supreme Court, I was alleging that it does not properly report its determinations of violations of laws within its jurisdiction. You would think the Office of Special Counsel, seeing it's acting in my interest, would at least say, well, let's try to get a court review of this so we'll all be on the same page. And in fact, OSC was bending over backwards, pleading with the court, please don't look at how we interpret this law. Please, 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 court, don't look at it, right? Hello? You know, so the court, in fact, in the Sixth Circuit is where the case was heard, it says, this is what Carson says, and this is what OSC says, all right? So at least it lays out the issues, and then it says, because OSC didn't want us to look at it, we won't. Carol Lerner could turn that around. She could say, I want you to look at it, you
right.
know? That's my point.
Well, we'll be watching for that, and keep me updated on developments, and I can pass it along to our listeners. Now, let's move to the petition. Because you have started a petition on the White House website, and to explain it all, you set up a website at broken-covenant.org. Explain what you think the broken covenant is. I think people have an idea. And then describe what your petition is asking for.
Okay, well, I use the term broken covenant to describe the Civil Service Reform Act, in which, and I'll say the broken covenant between, at this point, the president and the federal civil service, in that the president has the duty to faithfully execute the laws, which, with respect to the federal civil service, means he's responsible to ensure that federal employees are adequately protected from prohibited personal practices so they can do their duties for protecting the health, safety, security, and welfare of the American people per the Merit System principles. And that's the broken covenant. Federal employees are not adequately protected from prohibited personal practices. And you know, that was the, when you take an oath, as every federal employee, member of the civil service, takes an oath, quite similar to the one taken by the president about supporting the Constitution, faithfully executing the laws. Well, I'm trying to, but you know, who's got my back? They're supposed to be protecting me from prohibited personal practices, and ultimately I'm saying it's the president. And if he's not going to ensure that these agencies are, if the reasonable questions are raised, then I think it's incumbent upon him to get answers, and that's what the petition calls for. And the other piece I want to share with your listeners, Peter, you know, people could say, well, Carson's pleading his own case, and he's not an attorney. And I was like, all right, that's fair. So I hired an attorney, and I said, don't be my advocate like you're the judge. Give me your best legal opinion about my concerns. Are they valid or not? And what would be an appropriate way, if they are valid, to get them resolved? And it's linked to my website. He found all my concerns at least reasonable. Some are compelling. And the Office of Legal Counsel, which is part of the executive branch, it's in the Department of Justice, and it's the ultimate referee within the executive branch as to how a law is to be interpreted, is the appropriate way within the executive branch to get them resolved. Now, I'm trying to get it resolved, you know, through the judicial system, but if the Office of Legal Counsel, they, you know, being as there is no precedent about the laws in question at this point, the Office of Legal Counsel, working for the Attorney General, can say, this is how these laws should be interpreted, Mr. President. Or, since it's civil service law, it applies to all agencies, any agency head could task the Attorney General to say, you know, is the Office of Special Counsel properly interpreting the law, or is the MSPB improperly interpreting this law, so I can make sure I'm properly interpreting my duties to prevent prohibited personal practices, because they all work together. But that's what the point of the petition is, to ask the president to, via the attorney general, to task the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, which is the government agency that's, again, created to be the referee for how laws to be interpreted within the executive branch, are the three laws that correspond to those roles of agency head, Office of Special Counsel, Merit Protection Board. Have they been properly interpreted for the last 33 years? You know, inquiring minds would wish to know.
Yeah.
And if they have been, okay, fine. Well, that's a data point that could be used, because both the Office of Special Counsel, Merit Protection Board, they're overdue for congressional reauthorization. So this would be some data that could be used. Well, you want to change the law, here's another piece of data to use for that. And if they haven't been, Peter, I think that's good news in a way. I mean, it's good news, bad news. But it's good news in the sense that a previously unidentified factor in much that has gone wrong in this federal government in the last 33 years has been identified, and it can be corrected. You know, so I think that's, in a sense, that's good news. You know, things aren't maybe as bad as they otherwise might seem. It might be somewhat analogous to saying, you know, if you're in the Army and your unit keeps losing. Well, if you find out you got a spy, well, it's bad news you had a spy, but it's good news because that might be explain why you kept losing, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm not doing this, you know. Yeah, I have to have something motivating me. I don't think I'm coming across as delusional or traumatized, right?
No.
I can walk away from this deal. We just say, fine, peace, you know?
Not so far. I don't think you're delusional at all.
I don't want to tell other federal employees you have to look the other way. I don't want to have to tell other engineers, you know, the whole paramount to public health, safety, welfare, except when it's economically inconvenient, then do what you got to do. That's not a good formula in 2011, Peter. So.
And you need 25,000 signatures to this petition on the White House website by November 11th, right?
Yes, and that, even though, according to the website, if you get 25,000, then the White House will formally respond. Now, there's some, you know, the White House says we may formally respond anyway. You know, but if I get 25,000, then the White House is on the hook to formally respond to the petition. Doesn't mean it has to accept it. It just has to formally respond to it. But the more people we get on the petition, I think the more likelihood is that President Obama will say, all right, there's enough people, you know, enough people want to know what the answer is. And I'm trying to put myself in his shoes. It would take some moral courage on his part to say, you know what, the federal government has for 33 years failed to adequately protect its federal employees from prohibited personal practices, and that does explain a lot that's gone wrong. We weren't just fools. We were knaves. We may not have known it, but we really, you know, if you follow what I'm saying, Peter,
but
9/11, there was no, all the government might have been foolish, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't knavish, if you will, all right? And I'm saying no, knavery, you know, knavery was a factor, if I'm correct, and that's, that puts things in a little different perspective, I think. And I would take, you know, kind of like the Catholic priest. That was just this rogue priest that was a, you know, no, a lot of people knew when the bishops were looking the other way. You know, they're saying it changed the perception, the cast of what really was going on.
Well, I think your comparison there is quite accurate, because we have the Catholic bishops who are aware of the predatory priests, and in many cases, under directions from the Vatican, they, instead of removing these people from the priesthood and from contact with children, they would just move them to a new parish for a fresh set of victims.
Right.
And that is beyond passive negligence. It takes on a whole different color.
Well, it puts it where the bishops are looking out for their institution more than the people. And that's my point here. Is the president going to look out for the institutions of government, or is he going to look out for the American people? And if he's going to look out, just I got to maintain the reputation of the government. I can't admit we were doing these kind of wrong things. I don't think that's really looking out. I don't really think that's consistent with your oath, Mr. President. I really don't. And I really think I, Joe Carson, have you know, taken a couple of blows to help my oath, Mr. President. You know.
Well, Joe, you set a good standard, and I'm glad that you're fighting to hold people to it. And I'm going to link to the Broken Covenant website in the show file here that's linked to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. I'm going to sign your petition, and I hope that all our listeners will as well.
And I hope, you know, Peter, when we get an answer, I will let you know. And if you don't have me back, perhaps you can put it up on the website. Because if my concerns are vindicated, you know, again, it won't be happy that I'm right, but at least we know another cause of what's causing so many of our problems, and we can fix it.
Yeah. Joe Carson, thanks for talking with us again today.
Thank you, Peter.
And now, stand-up comic and sit-down satirist Will Durst checks in with comments on the recent spate of Republican presidential debates.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here to sound the alarm about a serious political epidemic sweeping the nation today. America is deep in the throes of a severe case of debate fatigue, and nowhere are the symptoms more apparent than amongst the GOP candidates themselves, as evidenced by their most recent gathering in Nevada, which by any unofficial tally should count as the 367th debate in the past 4 months with only 519 to go. You could say the last debate got a bit testy. You could also say that Girl Scouts make ineffective NFL middle linebackers, especially in nickel coverage. You think the voters are annoyed? You should see the candidates. Starting to get on each other's nerves like somebody else's disco music pinning the red in a bathroom with stainless steel walls. After Rick Perry accused Mitt Romney of hiring illegal aliens to work on his lawn, the two squared off and only the presence of TV cameras kept them from making a date to meet under the bleachers right after school. Perry's frustration is evident. Seemingly unable to form a complete sentence in public, he admitted, "Debates aren't my strong suit." No, not your strong suit. Weak suit, leisure suit, or birthday suit. Face it, debates aren't your Bermuda shorts. And neither is foreign policy Herman Cain's black socks with sandals. All seven of the presidential wannabes tried to one-up each other on who would implement the strictest immigration enforcement by variously promising to utilize an electric fence, predator drones, and I think someone mentioned alligator pits. Michelle Bachmann was confused by Libya being in Africa. Ron Paul kept his eyebrows on, and Newt Gingrich may have scuttled his entire campaign when he vowed his nominee to engage President Obama in a series of 7 3-hour-long debates. Yeah, smooth move. Like telling a man with heartburn you plan on serving nothing but Tabasco jalapeno burritos for dinner for the next 2 weeks, and the sour cream has curdled. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Check out our website, peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.